Catherine, what a joy to celebrate your ordination. When you arrived at UUCF in the fall of 2021 to begin a two-year internship, you had already had successful careers in medicine, in the military, policy grant writing, not to mention yoga instructor on the side. Nevertheless, you sensed that your vocational trajectory might still be incomplete. You felt a call to ministry. As I was reflecting on what to say on this, your ordination day, I stumbled upon these words from a recently published book about Carl Jung that perhaps speaks to some of why you went through the many, 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 many steps that are required to become a Unitarian Universalist minister instead of remaining content with any one of your successful careers. Jung writes this: "People don't realize just how much they're putting at risk when they don't accept what life presents them with, the questions and the tasks that life sets them. I've come to the conclusion that it is better to live what one really is and accept the difficulties that arise as a result, because avoidance is even worse. Suffering is inevitable in any case, but I want to suffer those things that really belong to me. In old age, it is not the wonderful things that we perhaps missed out on seeing or experiencing that we will most regret. What we will most regret are any moments when we let life pass us by." Catherine, we are gathered here to celebrate that you have not let your call to UU ministry pass you by. Allow me to add one more quote from Jung, which underscores that I think in no sense are you missing out on anything by coming to UU ministry in midlife. Rather, our living tradition gains from all of your previous experience. Moreover, Jung challenges us to consider there might be something in particular to pay attention to, and this is for all of us, something to pay attention to in the changes that we humans feel compelled to make in what he calls the second half of life. He's not talking about buying a Ferrari. In his words, "One cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be of little importance in the evening, and what in the morning was true will in the evening be a lie." Since Catherine and I share a heritage of having Christianity as a significant part of our respective first half of life, I want to invite us to go a little deeper into that quote from Jung using the lens of the Christian tradition. Our perspective can change in quite interesting ways as we enter what Jung called the second half of life. As another wisdom teaching puts it, we see the world not merely as it is. We see the world as we are. And sometimes as we are in the first half of life, we come to see the same. The things haven't changed, but we change. We see the world not merely as it is, but as we are. Let me give you an example. When I was a newly ordained minister back in 2003, I related to some of Jesus' sayings quite differently than I do today. Back in my mid-20s, within what Jung called the first half of life, my inclination was to interpret Jesus' words quite literally as this literal challenge to change your life in this precise way that an itinerant Jewish peasant had changed his 2,000 years ago. It's no coincidence that when the historical Jesus preached words we're going to go into a little bit more, that he himself was likely in his late 20s, and it was likely to even younger men, likely teenagers, his disciples, that he gave these instructions that are in the 10th chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew. He said, "Cure the sick." You're already on that one. Check, right? "Cure the sick. Raise the dead. Cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You received without payment, give without payment. Take no gold or silver or copper in your belts. Take no bag for your journey. Do not take two tunics or sandals or a staff, for laborers deserve their food." This is not to say that one can only be radical in one's youth. I've met some incredibly radical folks at the end of their life. But there does tend to be a greater openness to giving up everything in the first half of life. And there are stories I could tell you of living for brief periods of time in a few different intentional communities, of organizing protests against the Iraq War and other such adventures. But looking back, I can see that there are ways in which my window for a certain kind of radicality was closing by the time I accepted my first call to be a full-time minister. Indeed, accepting a paid position was itself a compromise. Even a paid position to be like a professional Christian, right, whatever that is, I didn't move to another state to follow Jesus for free. I negotiated a contract. The congregation paid me a salary with benefits. After 2 years, I bought a house. But that's not how Jesus' standard operating procedure imagined it. Rather, he said, whatever town or village you enter, find out who in it is worthy, and stay there until you leave. As you enter the house, greet it. If the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house or town. Now, unlike the historical Jesus, I'm not an itinerant peasant. Today, I have a wife, a mortgage, a 7-month-old son, a full-time job, and if we skip ahead 9 chapters in Matthew's gospel, we can read Jesus' clear answer to what he thinks or thought homeowners like me should do. He said to the rich young ruler, if you wish to be perfect, go. Sell your possessions. Give money to the poor. Have treasure in heaven. And follow me. Now, there was a time when I wanted to be perfect. At least that's what I thought I wanted, but as you've heard me quote one of my colleagues before, it turns out we are saved from perfection. These days, I feel like being perfect, whatever that even means, might be a goal better suited to the first half of life. These days, I'm trying to be more compassionate with myself and others, more honest about my limitations, more open to being imperfect, that is, to being human. There's another twist to this story that was also less obvious to me in the first half of my life. This gets back to the Bible hasn't changed, but I've changed, right? We see the world not as it is, but as we are. Jesus' standard operating procedure actually requires that not everyone be an itinerant homeless peasant. There need to be householders for those itinerant peasants to have anyone to visit. Otherwise, there would be no homes for the disciples to deem worthy or unworthy, no houses on which they might leave their peace or shake off the dust from their feet, no hearths at which they might eat in exchange for all that sick curing and dead raising and leper cleansing and demon exorcising. But I couldn't see that in the first half of life. I was so identified with the disciples that Jesus and Jesus himself even, right? Talked to a therapist about that, I'm sure. Now, our Unitarian Universalist living tradition has always been more interested in Jesus' ethics rather than worshiping him. But for any of us either unable or unwilling to enact what we might consider Jesus' plan A, be perfect, sell your possessions, give the money to the poor, I invite you to consider plan B. But to get to plan B, I want to take us on the briefest detour through the Hebrew Bible. Near the end of this passage from Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, quote, truly I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town that did not offer you a good place to stay. Now, modern debates about same-sex relationships have gotten many people confused about Sodom and Gomorrah. But if you read the full context of that story in Genesis 18, you will see that the so-called sin in this infamous clobber passage, right? Passages we use to beat each other up, right? Do y'all know the saying, texts don't mean, people mean with text. They create meaning and they're mean to each other with them. If you read that passage, you'll see that the sin in this passage, it's actually not homosexuality, it's inhospitality. The concern is not the presence of consensual adult same-sex relationships, it's the absence of justice. Ezekiel 16:49, so you had this other interesting thing that we could talk about, that like you had these waves of canon, so that like for the Old Testament, the Hebrew prophets, their Bible was the Torah. And then for like Jesus, his Bible, he always said, you know, not the Hebrew Bible, because part of it wasn't even finished yet, right? He always talked about the Torah and the prophets. So like for Ezekiel, commenting on his Bible, which was the Torah, he knew that story in Genesis 18. So you can read in Ezekiel 16:49, it says, quote, "This was the guilt of your sister Sodom." This is Ezekiel preaching a sermon on Genesis 18. "This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride. They had excess of food, and they had a prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy." In light of that passage from Ezekiel, we can form a plan B along these lines. Instead of be perfect, can you be humble? Instead of sell everything, can you share with those who have less than you? If you are in a state of prosperous ease, can you be hospitable to those who are poor and needy? Now, I'm not the first person to flip the script on Jesus' instructions to his disciples. In addition to the small number of books eventually collected in this anthology we now call the New Testament, early Christians wrote many other documents. Among the most helpful from a householder perspective is called the Didache. It literally means the teaching. So think about our English word didactic, right? This ancient book is dated to the mid to late first century. It was thought lost, only to be surprisingly rediscovered in a library in Turkey in 1873. As late as the fourth century, some prominent early Christian writers even considered it to be on the fringe of the New Testament canon, but it was ultimately not influential enough in enough geographic areas to make the final cut. The Didache is in many ways a manual for adapting the way of Jesus to the duties and concerns of family, of occupation, of home, the very things that Jesus and his wandering apostles had chosen to leave behind. The Didache attests that charismatic followers of Jesus' way are continuing to circulate and speak prophetically for the divine in exchange for essentially temporary room and board. And in chapter 11 of the Didache, the need is clear for householders to practice hospitality. It says, quote, "Welcome the teacher when he comes to instruct you." And whereas Jesus' instructions focus on whether a house or town is worthy or unworthy of receiving peace, the Didache's instructions are written from the opposite perspective. As a supplement to these Gospels according to Matthew and the Gospel according to Luke and John, we could perhaps think of the Didache as the Gospel according to the householders. And you know, that word gospel means good news, right? And to me, like Matthew was like more good news to me in the first half of my life, and the Didache seems more like good news to me now. For householders, their question is whether is yet another traveling disciple knocking on the door legitimate or illegitimate? So all of the disciples are like, is this house worthy or unworthy? And they're like, is this a legitimate teacher? In the tradition of all those who have been fooled by hucksters and charlatan and con men offering a hope that turns out to be snake oil, the Didache is interested in a litmus test for distinguishing true and false prophets. Whereas Jesus says, be perfect, the Didache is pragmatic. It says, quote, "For if you are able to bear the entire yoke, you will be perfect. But if you can't, can you do what you can? Can you at least do what you can?" There is a similar pragmatism regarding prophets. By your fruit, you will know them. That verse always makes me think of a bumper sticker. I used to see it more commonly in the South. It says that God wants spiritual fruits, not religious nuts. It's also noteworthy that the Didache has only a brief description of true prophets, but quite a long list of how to identify false prophets, a guide to spotting spoiled fruit, if you will. One of my favorites is, quote, "If the prophet stays 3 days, the prophet is false." The Didache community seemed to be familiar with Jesus' commission for his followers to travel itinerantly, again, without food, possessions, or money, so they'd keep going, keep spreading the good news. If someone wants to stay in one place too long, they risk exploiting the gift of hospitality and not doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is getting out there and spreading the good word. Also in line with Jesus' charge to his followers, the Didache cautions, "When the apostle goes away, let the apostle take nothing but bread to last until the next night of lodging. And if the prophet asks for money, the prophet is a false one." The Didache continues, "If he wants to stay with you and is an artisan, let him work for his living." But if he has no trade, use your judgment in providing for him, for one should not live idle in your midst. I love that the text warns further that, quote, if he is dissatisfied with this sort of arrangement, he is a Christ peddler. I love, we need to bring back that term. He is a Christ peddler. Watch that you keep away from such people. Anyway, Christ peddler could really help us distinguish from those who are truly a prophet, prophet, and those only interested in profit, profit. The perspective I've been sharing is by no means the only or best interpretation of these texts or of the Christian tradition. It's just how I've come to see things in this season of my life. My mind may continue to change. We see the world not merely as it is. We see it as we are. For now, I will say that I look forward, Catherine, to all that you will bring to our living tradition in this season of your life. We don't need you to be perfect. We just need for you, for me, for we, to use our gift and our calling to act in this world with more humility, more generosity, more hospitality, more peace, and always, most centrally, with more love.